From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Texas, where recently 100 top-level researchers came to the state to search for cancer treatments. Well, how did Texas poach talent from other places? One obvious answer is money. Texas invested in a new state priority on research funding, and now an association of New York medical schools is essentially asking our state to do the same. Is this how we can cure certain cancers or triumph over diseases? It's possible. Advocates also say it's also how we create jobs and prevent other states from stealing our talented men and women. So how much should taxpayers contribute? How does the process work? What's coming next? Let me welcome our guests for the hour. The Vice Dean of Research at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry is here. That's Steve Dewhurst. And Steve, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Evan.
And on the line, we have Joe Wiederhorn, who's the president of the Associated Medical Schools of New York. Joe, welcome as well.
Thank you very much.
Joe, why don't you lay out first for us what your organization's asking for? What do you want New York State to do?
Well, we're asking that the state contribute $50 million towards a fund that would help us bring in new researchers into the state. But what these researchers would really do would be to develop new laboratories. And each one of these laboratories would recruit new people. It would improve the number of researchers and the number of jobs within the state's economy. So the medical schools themselves are looking at matching this 2-to-1 so that for every dollar the state would contribute, the medical schools would contribute $2. And we would, in effect, start 50 small businesses every year, each of which would employ between 8 and 10 people.
All right. Essentially, the metric that I'm seeing is $1 million investment by the state, which, again, would be matched 2-to-1 by the recipient, would enable the recruitment of a laboratory, 8 to 10 employees. Is that right?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And just to put it out there, you know, each one of these jobs are very well-paying jobs. The average salary would be about $70,000 a piece. And the individuals would be recruited to a medical school where they would not only get the high salaries, but they also get very good benefits packages.
Now, Steve Dewhurst, when we look at the competition aspect of it, I think we've been hearing for a number of years now. I think the first conversation I had about this was with Joel Seligman himself, maybe a better part of a decade ago, about the concern about losing talent to other places. So I mentioned Texas off the top of the hour, and you were nodding right away. Why?
Because we've lost faculty to Texas. We've lost faculty to a number of other places. We obviously also recruit faculty, but if I was just thinking before we went on air about places we've lost faculty to recently. So Florida, for example, has a significant initiative from the state for funding biomedical researchers focusing on cancer. We've lost a couple of investigators to Florida very recently. We've lost one to Texas going to a cancer institute, MD Anderson. Lost another of my close colleagues to Georgia. Georgia has a $600 million investment in its research alliance. Now, having said that, we're also successful at recruiting people, but we would be more successful and we would recruit more people if we were able to partner with the state in the way that Joe's articulated.
Okay, and I think this is a good hour for just the average person who's interested in medical research and the average taxpayer who wants to know how the system's going to work to weigh in with questions. I already have a couple that have come in via email. Listeners, if you want to call the program, you can do that. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Steve, I said at the top of the hour, too, we talk about, well, how are we going to cure cancer? I mean, that's sort of a cliche now. A lot of people are working on that. And, of course, that's part of a goal. Cancer is very diverse, and there's lots of different forms. And there's a lot more than just cancer that you're working on. But how do you go after this kind of funding without overpromising? I mean, we don't know what comes out of this, right?
Well, so I think to the points that Joe made, the relevant arguments, I think, really are perhaps twofold. One is an economic development argument that Joe really laid out very clearly, that you create 8 to 10 jobs. Those people are all taxpayers. So the actual cost
for every million, 8 to 10 jobs for every million.
Correct.
Okay.
But over time, the tax revenue that will be collected from those individuals and the goods and services they buy and what their family members spend and so on amounts to a significant amount of money that will largely offset most of the state's cost. The second point and I'll come back to the economic argument in a second. The second point is, of course, is that this is an investment in good. This is things that will make people's lives better. It's an investment in cures. And that, I think, distinguishes this from many other kinds of investment that we could make at the state. And then maybe the last sort of point on economic development is, this is the creation of intellectual property, knowledge, that leads to the formation of startup companies, to the licensing of patents, and to other forms of revenue that will come into the state as a consequence of the information generated in the knowledge economy.
Now, Joe's going to be able to tell us, I think, what the feedback has been so far from state lawmakers. But Steve, as the Vice Dean of Research at the U of R School of Medicine and Dentistry, if I'm a state lawmaker and I want to get in the room with you and say, before I decide, you know, which way I want to stand on whether the state should be investing this money, you're the Vice Dean of Research. What's the research that's happening now? What kind of research specifically would this money go into in short order?
Short order, for example, musculoskeletal. It's figuring out illnesses and diseases that affect people's mobility throughout the rest of their lives, arthritis, diseases of tendons and ligaments, joint replacement, making that safer and more effective for more people, neuromedicine. It's treating diseases of aging. It's treating autism spectrum disorders. It's treating intellectual disabilities. It's a whole range of things. We have a program that really does span the waterfront at the medical center, but there are certain areas for us that are signature strengths where we're really very, very able to compete at the highest level nationally. That includes cancer, includes musculoskeletal, includes cardiovascular, includes infection and immunity. We're a place where many vaccines have been invented. We want to continue that tradition. You require people to do that. The capital and the what makes the university a success is its people, period.
All right.
So if I could just break in for a second, I think to get back to your original question, I think we can't really say that if the state puts in $50 million, we're going to find a cure for X. But what we can say is that if the state puts in $50 million, what we will be able to do is recruit some of the biggest and brightest stars in this country in terms of biomedical research. And so even if, for instance, Rochester were to recruit somebody whose research is focused on cancer, a specific kind of cancer, or on musculoskeletal diseases, you never know what it is that they're going to discover. While they're looking for that particular cure or that particular treatment, they could very well come across a treatment for something completely different. And that's one of the miracles of research, and it's also one of the things that makes researchers, that gets them very excited about the work that they do. And it also is very good for the state because it doesn't necessarily pigeonhole us into saying, well, we're going to be the state that's going to find the cure for cancer, and here is our $50 million to do it. But rather, we're the state that's really going to look at the whole array of diseases that are currently being investigated by researchers and see, gee, maybe we'll find something that relates to Zika virus while we're looking for something related to HIV or along those lines. So I think that's also something that's really important for people to understand, that it's not necessarily a linear discovery that's being made once the money is put in.
Steve Dewhurst, how common is that scenario?
Actually, more common than you'd think. When Joe was saying that, I was thinking about a colleague of mine I've worked with for the last 20 years. He's an HIV/AIDS researcher. He's interested in the neurologic complications of that disease. And so for a long time, he's really been interested in coming up with new treatments that would allow people with HIV to retain mental acuity throughout their life. And currently, that's something of a concern for some people with HIV. In the course of doing that, it turns out that he's come up with a small molecule that looks quite active in models for HIV, turns out also to be active in models for multiple sclerosis. So completely different disease, but there are some similarities in the way that neurons are damaged and destroyed that allow a therapy developed for one indication, in fact, to potentially have value for another. Another great example that's not from the medical center, well, actually is from the medical center, but it goes back quite a long time, is a discovery of small RNA molecules as being important in regulating gene expression. And this all came about in studies of a model organism called Tetrahymena, which is a little ciliated beast that lives in water and not of any great obvious relevance to human health. But it turns out that that discovery ultimately led us to develop siRNA and other ways of regulating gene expression therapeutically that are leading to treatments being developed right now. So that what, to Joe's point, those fundamental discoveries drive the future of science over actually quite a long time period. And that's important, too, that patience takes time.
All right. I've got plenty more questions, and our listeners do as well. And let me open up with John in Rochester. First up, go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. I got a quick question. Why doesn't the U of R and other universities invest in themselves? They have a huge endowment at the U of R and other universities. And what better confidence in creating future profits with their own endowment funds versus putting it on the taxpayers again?
That's a great question.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
In fact, we do. So one of the underappreciated things about research is that it costs the U of R and all institutions like us actually a great deal of money. So for every federal dollar we bring in, we spend 53 cents internally to fund the actual full cost of research. That includes running the laboratories, paying the salaries of people that aren't covered by grants, which turns out to be a lot of faculty salaries, supporting people over time. So it turns out that the size of our research program is dictated really in large measure by our internal endowment as well as by money from the outside. But we spend an enormous amount of money paying for research because it's our institutional mission. It's what distinguishes the U of R, for example, as a medical center from some of the other medical entities in town. We're a research institution, and that's just defining for us. It's our mission.
How much is the endowment at the U of R? I'd like to see more of it.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that we're doing everything we can with fundraising for the university to direct that towards research priorities. One of the things that's important about fundraising to realize, perhaps, is that a good deal of that is directed by donors to things that they think may be important. So, for example, a donor may decide to give money to a scholarship. Scholarships are very important for education and providing opportunity, but they don't necessarily go to support research, and we're not allowed to redirect those funds from a donor's wishes to some other purpose. So, in fact, it turns out that while we do have, as you're pointing out, we have a substantial endowment, certainly the largest of any of the local schools, compared to some of our peers in the research world, in fact, our endowment is relatively low, which may sound strange, but is in fact true. And the size of our endowment really does dictate the scope of our research programs so that, you know, wherever possible, we direct as much of that money to research as we possibly can because it's the mission-defining activity for us.
All right. Before I get back to the phones, let me turn to Joe Wiederhorn, the president of the Associated Medical Schools of New York, with just a follow-up there, because what Joe has told us is that for every $1 million invested by New York State here in medical research, it's going to be matched 2-to-1 by the recipient. So, you know, John might be wondering, and people like John might be wondering, Joe, if New York State does not invest $1 million or $50 million, would that 2-to-1 still be spent 2-to-0? Are the research institutions still spending the money anyway? And do we need that state money to get this kind of the ball rolling there?
Well, yes. I mean, the schools in the state will still spend money to recruit and to bring in new researchers so that we can, in fact, compete with the rest of the country. And I think that that's what really the bottom line is. We want to be able to compete with the rest of the country. We want to be able to have the ability to access the new dollars that are coming down from the federal government. You know, the president just put into his proposed budget money for precision medicine, for his precision medicine initiative, and for the cancer moonshot initiative. And these are all, you know, potential for new funds coming into the state. But unfortunately, other states, you mentioned, and Steve mentioned Texas at the beginning of the hour, but states also like Georgia, like Connecticut, Massachusetts, Indiana, they're all putting in money so that they can position themselves so that they will be able to compete for these new dollars, which is exactly what we need to do here, because the researchers follow the money. They follow where they have the potential for doing the basic science research, for being able to make the discoveries, and we want to be able to bring in that money into the state. So I'll give you a good example. A number of years ago, the state supported a program very similar to what we're talking about today. They put in about $38 million into that program. In return, the researchers were able to leverage $250 million in new grants. That's new grants, new philanthropy. That's not economic leverage, you know, indirect economic leverage. Sorry, but what it is new grants that they were able to bring in. Thus, they're able to bring in more staff. They're able to advance their research. And that's why it's so important for the state to put the money in. The schools will still continue to do it, but we need that extra push so that we can say we're competitive, which we are quickly losing our competitive edge.
All right, Kelly in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Kelly.
Yes, I had a question about just who would be recruited to the area. I know that we have such an almost crisis in STEM education in the states here. Is there any way to know whether this would go towards recruiting folks who are either already here in the states or American scientists versus recruiting people into the country? I know that sometimes that talent is abroad, so I'm wondering how much of that money would be used for recruiting here in the states.
Let me give you at least an answer for how we recruit at the U of R, and then Joe can give you an answer that relates more to the specific legislation. In general, at U of R, while we recruit foreign-born people, and I'm foreign-born myself, so I'm a U.S. citizen now, but I came here to the States from England over 30 years ago. I've been at the U of R 25 years, and along the way, I became an American citizen, like, in fact, many of our scientists do. But I was educated in my PhD in the U.S., and I trained in the U.S. And that's a typical hiring pattern. In other words, that we hire U.S.-trained scientists, people who already work in the U.S. system and who are committed to staying here. And the reason for that is they're simply more competitive in the U.S. funding system. They understand how the system works. They understand how to write grants. So the nationality, in a sense, I don't think matters so much as the fact that they're committed to staying as part of this community and as part of the U.S., and that they are not being recruited directly from abroad, because for the vast majority, people recruited directly from overseas don't have the familiarity with the U.S. funding system to succeed. There are some exceptions to that, but I'm sort of making a generality. If you were to look at people we've recruited recently, I was thinking about that before I came on the show with Evan. And just to give you a few examples, you know, we recruited a guy by the name of Ray Dorsey from Johns Hopkins. He's a neurologist, works in Parkinson's disease, U.S. trained. David Linehan is the chair of our Department of Surgery. We thought he was the best available surgeon in the country to lead that department. He's a researcher and a clinician, came from WashU. Gretchen Burbeck is an outstanding researcher in malaria and epilepsy. She joined us from the University of Michigan State University. And then Martha Susiaggio is a brand new faculty member interested in gene-environment interactions, and she's from Pennsylvania. So those are just examples of faculty that we've hired. But what they all have in common is that they're U.S. trained. In fact, all the ones I'm listing are also U.S. citizens. But it's that U.S. training, that background, and the commitment to stay here. We're as concerned, I think, as probably most listeners are. We want to grow the intellectual capital of the Rochester region because it's good for us, but it's also good for the community and the whole area. It's that community that creates a demand for STEM education. You know, my kids, for example, went to school in the Brighton School District. On any parent night in Brighton, who do I run into? I run into all my colleagues. One of the drivers of excellence in many of our school districts is the involvement of parents who've got a background that values STEM education just like you do.
Does that help, Kelly?
Yes, that's my concern, is the use of the funds and how it can be used to kind of further the STEM education of American children. And I think sometimes when we look abroad for that talent, then it kind of lets U.S. schools off the hook. So I do appreciate that answer, because I agree, having those parents, people who are committed to being here and staying here like your guest does definitely push school districts to do a better job. So thank you.
Yeah, Kelly, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate that very much. Let's go to Patrick in Rochester.
Could I just respond for a second?
Before we go to Patrick. All right, Patrick, hang there. Joe's going to jump in. Joe Wiederhorn's president of the Associated Medical Schools of New York. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, thank you. And I'll be very brief. I just wanted to reiterate something that Steve said. If you listen to the list of people who he had mentioned they had recruited, they're all from out of state. And that is one of the basic tenets of this, what we're trying to get through the legislature here. We want to recruit people from other states. We're not interested in having the University of Rochester hire someone from Buffalo. We want to have people who are entrepreneurial, who start startup companies, who will help the economy of the Rochester area, for instance. We want those funds to be used for that. And then in terms of STEM education for high school students, I just think it's really important for listeners to understand that the medical schools throughout New York State run programs that are down into the high school level. Some of them even go down into junior high school level to get kids interested in going into the STEM fields. They really feel that this is part of what their mission is in terms of training and getting kids interested and being part of the next generation of researchers. So I think the commitment is there from the state, and I think that these funds will help support that commitment.
All right, we're talking about the push for more research funding in New York State, and you're hearing Joe Wiederhorn, the president of the Associated Medical Schools of New York. They're calling for New York State to invest $50 million in research institutions for a number of reasons. And I think, as Steve Dewhurst laid out, first and foremost to say that he thinks it's the right kind of spending because it could have an economic impact with also a societal benefit of medical research. But if you've got questions, we're trying to answer them this hour with that. And let me turn to, let me grab Patrick in Rochester. I'm just trying to make sure we can. There we go. Let me grab. All right, there you are, Patrick. Go ahead.
Hello. When the research, and thank God for people who do this, is done, and of course published from here or elsewhere, how can it be kept sort of, this sounds very, well, a stateside, because it can well go then to offshore, Asian and other facilities, which of course have a far, far, far cheaper labor force. I mean, thousands of technicians and laboratories. Again, of course, you know, which pharmaceutical companies are also, you know, supporting. How can we keep that beautiful stuff, not to be selfish, but to keep it so that, because that's horrible to be, but see, how can we keep it here and grow from that and keep it not something that's sort of developed and then poof, like the photocopier, Kodak film, Fujifilm, and that this is far more important than stuff. This is medical research, and just
how do we
keep it and keep that in a, it, it, you know, keep it so those who do the work have more money from to research and more from what, you know, the results that they've begun.
Sure. And Patrick, let me jump in. Steve Dewhurst is the Vice Dean of Research at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, so I was going to respond in two ways, Patrick. One way is simply to make the observation that one of the important things about science is that all the information does need to be publicly available, at least for, I think, publicly funded science. That transparency and sharing of information is really terribly important. It's what advances the field. It's what gets at what was being raised earlier about these basic discoveries being used in applications one would never have thought of. That's a very general comment. Your specific comment was really, I think, oriented a little bit more to the biotech industry and to commercial application of scientific discoveries, which is slightly different. In those cases, those are going to be patent-protected ideas, and that really gets at the heart of why this initiative is so important. We want innovative, creative people who will come up with not only new discoveries, but patentable discoveries with commercial potential. And those commercially viable ideas then can be patented. They can be used to generate ultimately licensing revenue, startup companies here in the local community. That's part of the mission of the university is that kind of development of the community. And so in doing that, it turns out that the patent process helps with retaining some of that information here. So frankly does the expertise. If one's really expert in a particular kind of science, it's more difficult than you might imagine to reproduce that science somewhere else at a distance without that first-hand knowledge and experience. It's also true that if you're conducting the research and you're sort of active in the field, you have a significant head start. So if you can find the capital investment, it's possible to commercialize your activities and move forward very quickly, even if you might otherwise face a very large labor market. That's not actually necessarily the problem. The problem in many cases, frankly, is finding the funding to get your idea commercialized, which is a separate discussion for
sure,
a different day.
It is. And we've talked in the past about the state of funding, what gets funded and what doesn't. And so I feel like there's some overlap. So I just want to hit a couple of the quick questions before I go back to the phones, which is, first of all, and forgive the ignorance here, if New York State invests this $50 million, Steve, is the research that's generated from it, is it going to be essentially new research? Is it going to be kind of a backstop to make sure ongoing research doesn't hit a wall?
It definitely will not be a backstop, as Joe articulated. These are new hires from other states, bringing in new talent to the state of New York. And specifically, you know, let's talk locally, we're bringing new talent into the city of Rochester that will build our knowledge economy.
And some listeners have wanted to know, in terms of how this breaks down, and maybe you and maybe Joe can help with this, URMC would end up with what kind of chunk of that $50 million pie?
Well, let me respond to that, because
I think Steve's thrilled that Joe wants to jump in. Go ahead, Joe.
Pardon me?
Steve's thrilled that you want to take this one. Go ahead.
I bet he is. You know, the one thing about this pot of money that we're asking for is that all of the medical schools in the state have signed on to it. They've all agreed to it. So there's 16 medical schools in the state. When you look at it like that, $50 million is really not a lot of money. And what we've agreed to is that the schools would respond to a request for proposal. So if they have somebody that they would like to recruit, they want to start a lab related to some kind of research that's going on, they would apply for funding from this $50 million pool. And their application would be reviewed by it would be a peer-reviewed application, so that people from all over the country, we'd have a committee, an advisory committee, look at the applications and make a determination about, you know, whether or not this particular application from school A versus school C would be a good application. The lab would be doing research that was state-of-the-art, that has the potential for being turned into innovative medicines or medical devices or whatever in the future. So it would be competitively awarded to the schools throughout the state, and no one school would have a competitive advantage over another. Everyone would be on an equal footing.
Well, let me get a short break in here, and we'll come back with more of your phone calls, and we'll answer more of your questions with our guests, Joe Wiederhorn, the president of the Associated Medical Schools of New York, Steve Dewhurst, the Vice Dean of Research at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. There's an ongoing push to get New York State to commit to $50 million more for medical research. It's a competitive field, and we're talking about the impacts and the implications this hour. So more of your questions answered next. Coming up in our second hour, he traveled across the country at the age of 26 in 1970. He took hundreds of black and white photos, and for 40 years, those slides did nothing. But now, photojournalist Mark Brady has turned them into a new book. His work is on display this month at the Little Theater. You can see it there. And we're talking about America, 1970 and now, next hour.
Astronaut Scott Kelly is about to return from a year aboard the International Space Station.
I think the hardest part is being isolated, in a physical sense from people on the ground that are important to you.
His year in space and Super Tuesday reports from across the country later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson on Twitter. Trish writes to us, today I'm listening to local people call into Evan Dawson and let him know that their tax dollars should not pay for medical research. I hope Evan's producer polls each caller on who they plan to vote for president. Steve, do you want to say anything about that? You just want to say without comment?
Largely without comment. What I would say, though, actually, biomedical research has traditionally been a bipartisan issue. And in fact, you know, if you go back about 20 years or so, the strongest proponents of that were members of the Republican Party. So historically, both parties have embraced this. There's an economic development piece, there's a societal benefit piece, and there's a knowledge piece. I think each of those pieces appeals to perhaps slightly different groups of people. But overall, it has such tremendous value for us as a society. As the earlier caller pointed out, STEM education really rests on valuing research, showing what research does, and, you know, showing our kids this is really important stuff. Go learn about it.
And let me grab Keith in Farmington, who may want to weigh in on that very subject. Go ahead, Keith.
Have an interesting show. I got a couple comments here. From what I have met some doctors who their only job is research. They don't practice medicine like most people would assume a doctor does. And by talking to the doctors, they tell me that they're in Rochester as long as the grant money is there, because most of them will follow where the grant money goes. So you have a transient effect of the doctors come and going when the U of R or whatever agency you want to say gets the grant money. The second thing, I know that whatever the all-encompassing U of R School of Medicine or Strong Hospital, they all, the hospital is really deep into clinical trials to the tune of what I was told was about $500 million or so. And I know this firsthand because I've been paid to test medical apparatuses to the point where I've sold tissue from my organs that eventually go to research. I, as a taxpayer, don't have problems of giving the school $50 million of taxpayer money, but the amount of jobs it's going to create isn't going to be a whole heck of a lot. Now, if they come up with a new drug, say they make a stunning cure for medicine, it's not going to create a whole heck of a lot of jobs in the Rochester area. And I would like to see, okay, we'll give you the $50 million, but if you get something that you can sell or that you can patent, we would like our $50 million back. That's just from my point of view.
Keith, honestly, Thanks for the phone call. Let me start with Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, thank you. I understand that is a concern. But let's just play this out a little bit further, Keith. So $50 million. Let's just say that Rochester got the complete $50 million. We're talking about 4,000 to 5,000 jobs from the $50 million, which actually is quite a few jobs. And when you look at it in terms of what the average salary for one of these jobs is, it's around $70,000. Now, granted, there are some people who would make a little bit more. There would be some people who would make a little bit less. But every single one of these jobs, every person who would come into one of these jobs would be employed by the University of Rochester. They would get great benefits. And if you look at it in terms of the jobs coming with grants, the average NIH grant that comes in is for 4 years. So each one of these jobs is guaranteed 4 years' worth of funding at the same level, at the $70,000 or so level. So I can understand where it doesn't sound like a lot when you look at it in terms of 7 to 10 jobs per lab, but $50 million is 50 labs. Now, granted, that's a lot of labs to be created by one school, but we're talking about statewide here, so we're talking about 50 labs across the state, which is not undoable at all. So, you know, in terms of giving the money back, I think that, you know, that's also a concern. But I want to go back to something that Steve said from the very beginning, which is this money not only goes for economic development, but it goes to create and to support the public good. It goes to create better health care outcomes for people. And you yourself mentioned the clinical trials. Clinical trials are really very, very important. And not only are they important for testing the drugs, they're also important because they improve, they have the potential to improve people's health, where these people's health might not have, you know, they may be terminal, they may not have been able to walk, whatever it is, this is more than just a financial investment. It's an investment in the lives of our communities throughout the state.
All right, Steve?
Yeah, I'd agree with Joe, obviously. Just to put a couple of other things in context, the notion that scientists just pick up and leave a place because the grant money ends isn't quite as true as it may seem. I'm an example of that. I'm a PhD scientist. My only job is to do research. I've been in Rochester for 25 years, raised my children here. I love the place. And a huge number of my colleagues are exactly like me. They love this place. It's a wonderful community. They don't want to leave. And, the university can help support them during difficult times. That's part of the university's mission. It's part of what we use our endowment for. And that creates a stability. Stability is incredibly important to biomedical research. You don't want to be picking up and moving every couple of years if you can avoid it. I also wanted to touch quickly on the number of jobs created. As Joe pointed out, 4,000 to 5,000 jobs, if all of that $50 million were spent in Rochester. Obviously, it's not going to be. But to give that some context, 4,000 to 5,000 jobs would create one of the top 10 biggest businesses in the Rochester metro area. So that is not a small impact. It's a very big impact. And again, to give that another context, in fact, the current research mission at the University of Rochester already employs 3,000 people in aggregate. It is funded by about $1.2 billion of federal money over the last 5 years. And as a business, if it were a separate employer extracted out from the university as a standalone business, it would be in the top 10 in the Rochester metro area. So it's already a huge part of our local economy. And providing additional support for that, I think, is a very rational and wise investment, particularly when we look at what money we're also spending in terms of economic development. The regional economic development effort depends very much on technology and innovation. If you look at what we're doing in the Sibley building, we're creating an incubator for biomedical research that has wet laboratory space for development of new scientific ideas. Those ideas come out of places like the University of Rochester and the science it generates. And unless you have a large body of researchers working there, you won't generate the ideas to populate these spaces we've already invested in.
All right, Kate and Tim have been waiting. Let me grab Kate in Rochester. Go ahead, Kate.
I'd like to address the application of all of this wonderful research, so I'm not really saying and being negative about what we're talking about, but the application. What happens when, let's say, for example, pharmaceuticals get a hold of this, and I don't like them. I know they do wonderful work, but their hidden mantra is no cure, just care, because they don't really make any money on a cure. So now we're talking about handing this off to people who claim that advertising is their biggest cost, which isn't true, rather. And you have a CEO who decides that it's $20,000 a treatment. And then how available is this wonderful thing? We're talking about saving lives here. It doesn't matter where, if it's the U.S. or anywhere in the world. When they randomly will say, in the U.S., you're going to pay $20,000 per treatment, and in India, it's 150. I know that's extreme, but I mean, get me going. So I'd like to see keep in mind that this thing is handed off. And a lot of times also people need to know that when a pharmaceutical funds research, they have their fingers in the pie already, and they may want the patent. I mean, it's all like hidden values here and hidden system. But I think what my concern is that this wonderful thing will be held up like something that a lot of people won't have available as a treatment option.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kate.
Let me take a stab at answering that. And now I'm going to maybe answer you with a very specific example that I hope maybe you can derive a more generalized understanding from. So if you look at the HPV patent, for example, that was the human papillomavirus vaccine. It's the first cancer vaccine ever developed. It was developed in part at the University of Rochester. There were actually a total of 4 places that had issued patents for that concept. We were one of the 4. a drug company bought all four patents, aggregated them, and used them to develop a vaccine. What's interesting about the vaccine is it's a cure. In fact, it's a prevention. It's even better than a cure. So it completely prevents cervical cancer and goes against that notion that drug companies are simply in it for a buck or to propagate disease, if you want, to treat disease. So I don't necessarily believe that drug companies are entirely about treating disease. They're also about cures and prevention. And a lot of that's driven by the science. Once you make a vaccine, somebody is going to produce that vaccine because it's so important. And if, you know, you will find somebody who's willing to invest in that idea if it's a compelling enough vaccine for a new enough indication. If you look at treatments and things, you know, I'm not going to justify some of the recent excesses that have occurred with people in arbitrarily setting costs for
medications. You're talking about Martin Shkreli, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's no defending him. He's a loathsome human being, and I have no, you know, whatever happens to him, he thoroughly deserves, I'm sorry to say. However, you can look at some other diseases where the price per treatment is outrageous on the face of it, and they turn out to be far more difficult things to criticize completely. So, for example, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation is a foundation obviously developed and founded by people with CF or people who care about people with CF. That foundation developed some absolutely breathtakingly great drugs to treat CF, the first drugs available that are really effective in people with CF. They partnered with a drug company to develop those drugs and have since released them. The price per treatment per year is over $100,000 with those drugs. It's phenomenally expensive. But these were developed by a nonprofit that has no intention of getting rich. That's the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. They're using that to support follow-on research, and they're treating what is in fact a very small market of people. It's not everybody with CF. They have two kinds of drugs. One treats about half the people with CF. The other treats only 2%. But if you were in that 2% of people, your life has changed beyond recognition. If you're a family member of that 2% of people, your life has changed beyond recognition. It is so enormously better than it was before. So that's the difficulty, I think, at times of looking at biopharma and biotech, that we often look at the Martin Shkreli's and we just, you know, to use an English phrase, we're gobsmacked at the guy's greed. But not everybody's like that.
Yeah. Okay, let me get to Tim in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan. Just on a tangent for that emailer, I'm voting for Hillary, and I still have serious reservations about this money. And I don't say that. I say that as I know research does cost a lot of money, but just to a normal middle-class person, $50 million is a lot of money, no matter how you divide it or how you look at it. The one question I have, and maybe this is just a clarification, but I thought I heard Joe say that the recruitment is from people out of state. Was I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Why is there no one in Rochester or Buffalo or New York in general that can be recruited for this? I mean, I don't understand why their ideas...
Right. No, their ideas, it has nothing to do with whether or not their ideas are good, people in the state have better ideas or not as good ideas. The intent is to keep people in the state. And so we could recruit from one institution to another, but we want to grow the research community here. So whereas our schools are spending a lot of money, and I think Steve could talk a little bit about this, but we're spending a lot of money to keep people here in New York that are not going to be recruited out of state. But we also want to grow the whole industry here in the state. We want to grow the whole biomedical enterprise. And the way to do that is to not poach from one school to another, but to bring people in from out of state so that the enterprise grows. And we feel this is really important. As a matter of fact, we feel like, you know, the talent here is so terrific, we want to do whatever we can to keep them. And actually, part of the money would be able to be used to retain people in state who have offers to go out of state. And so it's for retention of current recruiters and for current researchers, and it's for bringing people in, but it's not so that Columbia University can recruit from Rochester or NYU can recruit from Buffalo. It's for new folks coming into the state.
Okay, I'm actually better with that, because as long as we're actively trying to keep people here that would go out of state that we would actually want for this, then that's good for me, because we're just losing really hundreds of thousands of people from the state every year. Anyway,
right. I'm sorry, Steve. Were you going to say something?
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. Go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to, chime in. I totally agree with Joe. It's a big issue for us at the university. It's a competitive business, the biomedical research business, and we have great faculty who are often very attractive to other institutions because of the quality of the work they're doing. So we're always working hard to retain the faculty that we have, as well as to bring in new faculty to add to that group of people. So our ability to be more effective in retaining the great people we have is really important.
Alex sends an email and just wants to know, can you clarify, $50 million is the ask. What is that on top of? In other words, what's the state investing already? Joe?
Well, right now the state is investing about $8 million a year for spinal cord research. For spinal cord research, and about $48 million a year for stem cell research specifically. And where we support those two asks, we think that, we're very supportive of that type of research. What we're looking for is a broader perspective in terms of where money can go and the types of research that can be done with it, so that, Rochester could bring somebody in who would be working on musculoskeletal issues, or could bring somebody in who's working specifically on Alzheimer's. So I think that, the state is good. We have no argument with what the state is doing now. We just feel that in order to be nationally and internationally competitive, we think the state should sort of step up and provide a little bit more funding.
And Joe, what are you hearing from lawmakers on this?
I think lawmakers are very interested in it. We've been talking to them. We've talked to them a couple of times. As we talk about the economic benefit, because of course, that's one of the things that the lawmakers are the most interested in, is this going, if the state invests money, what is our return on it going to be? So we've been providing them with the information about the return on investment in terms of, the economic, the employment, what the old program has done in terms of leveraging more dollars.
But do you think this is going to pass this year?
We are working very hard for it to pass this year. Of course, it's the legislature. It's not over until the budget season ends, so we're working on it.
Okay, a couple comments here. David on Twitter says, we might want to mention that 5,000 jobs means 5,000 highly paid taxpayers and a lab property tax, that is payback of investment. Robert in Fairport is on the phone and has a comment about the out-of-state nature of funding. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, this all sounds very Startup New York-ish to me, which is where the state sort of makes this deal where if you move a business to the state, you can pay no property tax or other taxes for 10 years, and it kind of puts people that are already here creates sort of an unfair playing field. I just think that this whole program is a Band-Aid, which is designed to circumvent the fact that New York State is not competitive at all when it comes to attracting people to come here. That's why you've got researchers you're losing researchers to states like Florida, for instance, and other places. And I just think this is more of a lobbyist kind of thing. And we'd all be better served if the state was more competitive and less time and money was spent on specialty things like this, which really misdirect tax dollars.
Thank you, Robert. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I understand that thinking. I don't know if I don't agree with it. I think that what the state has to do is to look at where the economy is going in terms of the national economy. What is the new economy? And the new economy really is in biotech and biomedical research. I think that we do need to stay competitive, and I think that if we're going to continue to grow as a state going forward, we need to invest in this because other states are, and other states are going to not only be able to draw down federal funds to help support this and to help support their economies,
but they're also going to be able to be eligible for more clinical trials, and it's going to impact not only the economy, but the state's health outcomes. And I guess my bottom line is that I really do disagree with the caller. I think that this is an important piece for us to remain competitive, and every little piece that we can add to it, every little dollar we can put into it, is going to mean very strong economic recovery for
the
state.
Well, for the other side, the last comment from a listener is Richard, who emails the program and says, Evan, I believe that state funds being provided for medical research in a 2-to-1 match is or should be the kind of private-public investment that we should all be working toward. The state and societal benefits that could be attained makes this kind of partnership a very good bargain or a no-brainer. That's from Richard. Steve Dewhurst, 30 seconds. What do you think?
I totally agree with Richard's point. I think, you know, to speak to the local economy, this is what we need to grow the local knowledge economy. It's what we need to really create that new vision for Rochester. It's really going to support a very strong research enterprise at the University of Rochester that's really central to much of what we want to accomplish in the local community. This is a top 10 employer, just the research activity alone at the U of R Medical Center, and this support will make that stronger.
And Steve, if we don't get this $50 million passed this year, is this state going to lose researchers in the next year as a result?
It will lose some.
Steve Dewhurst is the Vice Dean of Research at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Thanks for the time, Steve.
Thank you.
And Joe Wiederhorn, President of the Associated Medical Schools of New York. Thank you, Joe. I know we'll touch in again on this.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And a lot of phone calls, a lot of feedback this hour. Got through as much as we could. Thanks for all the participation. Short break and more connections next.